Good morning, everyone. Last week we finished reading about Savitri's discovery of the cosmic spirit and the cosmic consciousness. And now the next step. Now she's done all the preparation, everything. Now she is faced with the day on which Satyavan must die. And this next canto is numbered canto 3. There's an explanation of that in the footnote at the bottom, that this canto, the single canto of the Book of Death, was only lightly revised by Sri Aurobindo, and it is based on a very early version of Savitri, in which this death in the forest was canto 3. And so the editors have kept that title in reminder of this fact. It's interesting that from the very beginning of the poem, we have seen Savitri awakening on the day when Satyavan must die. Cantos 1 and 2 are focused on that day, or this day. And if we have a look at canto 2 of book 1, then we can see that it parallels what we are now about to read. The first canto is called The Symbol Dawn. Savitri awakes on the first day. And canto 2, which is the next one, comes on page 11. It's the beginning of the canto, The Issue, which tells us the whole background of this story. Why Savitri waking up now to the death of Satyavan? And it's recorded there that as she wakes up, she remembers everything that has happened to her since her youth until this day. It all runs past her consciousness. Everything that has happened from the meeting with Satyavan in the forest and the attempt by her parents to persuade her not to marry Satyavan, the meeting with Satyavan, all this has been already told in this vast flashback which starts here at the beginning of the poem. And now we're coming to the end of that flashback. We're back at this same moment when Savitri awakens in the forest. Sri Aurobindo chose not to revise this canto very much. He seems to have added only 10 or 15 lines to this shortest canto in the whole poem. But of course it's a crucial canto, because it tells of the death in the forest. This is the moment she has been preparing for. And we've heard the whole story from the beginning of canto 2 of book 1. Now that same day is taken up again in the narration. Would you like to read, Marie-Ange?
What canto are we reading? What page are we reading?
It is page 561.
561?
Yeah, but there's no page number on that.
On that page, right, yeah. So you have to look at the next page where it says 562. But we're going to start reading on page 561. And we'll read. It's, yes, we'll read first from the title. Yes.
This is Death in the Forest. Now it was here in this great golden dawn. While still the sleeping husband lay, she gazed into her past as one about to die looks back upon the sunny fields of life, where he too won and sported with the rest, lifting his head at the huge dark screen into whose depth he must forever plunge. What she had been and done, she lived again, the whole year in a swift and eddying race of of memories swept to earth and fled away into the irrecoverable past. Then silent she was, and service done, bowed down to the great goddess, simply carved as at her hand upon a forest stone. But there she breathed her soul and dug anew. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest huge, the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps she shrouded word, the shrouded voice spoke some still word.
Thank you. If you want to have a look at the beginning of Canto 2, we can go back there to page 11. The same moment is described differently, slightly differently. I'll read these first few lines. A while, withdrawn in secret fields of thought, as she wakes up, her mind moved in a many-imaged past that lived again and saw its end approach. Dying, it lived imperishably in her, transient and vanishing from transient eyes, invisible, a fateful ghost of self. It bore the future on its phantom breast. Along the fleeting events, far backward trail, regressed the stream of the insistent hours, and on the bank of the mysterious flood, peopled with well-loved forms now seen no more, and the subtle images of things that were, her witness spirit stood reviewing time. All that she once had hoped and dreamed and been flew past her eagle wing through memory's skies, as in a many-hued, flaming inner dawn, her life's broad highways and its sweet bypaths lay mapped to her sun-clear recording view from the bright country of her childhood's days, and the blue mountains of her soaring youth, and the paradise groves and peacock wings of love to joy clutched under the silent shadow of doom in a last turn where heaven raced with hell. 12 passionate months led in a day of fate. And this is that day of fate. So the first line of this canto, Death in the Forest, says, now it was here, this day of fate that Savitri has been preparing for the last 12 months. Don, would you read on from line 12?
11. Yes. Then silently she rose and, service done, bowed down to the great goddess simply carved by Satyavan upon a forest stone. What prayer she breathed her soul and Durga knew. Perhaps she felt in the dim forest huge, the infinite mother watching over her child. Perhaps the shrouded voice spoke still word. At last she came to the pale mother queen. She spoke, but with guarded lips and tranquil face, lest some straying word or some betraying look should get passed into the mother's unknowing breast, slaying all happiness and need to live. A dire foreknowledge of the grief to come. Only she needed utterance, passage found. Only she needed utterance, passage found. All else she pressed back into her anguished heart, and forced upon her speech an outward peace.
Yes. This is the next step. She's going to ask Satyavan's mother to give her permission to accompany him into the forest for the very first time in this whole 1 year that she's been living in that forest hermitage. She's never gone into the forest with Satyavan. Now, on this day that she alone knows is the day when Satyavan must die, she's going to ask his mother for permission to go to accompany him into the forest. Is it all clear? Anybody wants to ask anything? So what does she say? What next we have? The top of the next page, Savitri is speaking to Satyavan's mother. Mita?
One man that has lived with Satya on the endless edge of the vast woods, in the iron ring of the enormous peak, under the blue rifts of the forest sky. I have not gone into the silences of this great woodland that enshrine my thoughts with mystery, nor in its green places wondering. But this small hill was my world. Now has a strong desire seized all my heart to go with Satyavan, holding his hand, into the life that he has loved and touched, herbs he has trod, and know the forest flowers, and hear at ease the birds and the scurrying life that starts and ceases, the rich far rustle of the boughs and all the mystic whisperings of the woods. Release me now and let my heart have rest. She answered, do as thy wise mind desires, O calm child sovereign, with the eyes that dream. I hold thee for a strong goddess who has come, pitting our battle days. So dost thou serve, even as a slave might, yet art thou beyond all that thou doest, all our minds conceive, like the strong sun that serves earth from a man.
Thank you. So Satyavan's mother is a very appreciative and generous mother-in-law. No? Very kindly, with gratitude, she speaks to Savitri and credits her with great wisdom and power. Anandi. Thank you. So Satyavan is so happy to have Savitri with him for the first time, no? And he can show her all the places that he loves and tell her about the birds and the plants. He can echo the songs of the birds. He spoke of all the things he loved because he has grown up in this forest. These were his boyhood's comrades and playfellows, the creatures of the forest, no? Co-evils and companions of his life, as if they are the same age as he is. He has grown up with them. Savitri is listening, but she's not listening at all to what he's saying. She's only listening to the sound of his voice, because she knows that soon he will have to stop speaking, that she won't be able to hear that voice anymore. So every word that he speaks, she's carrying into her heart. She's not thinking about the meaning of the words that he's saying. She thinks about death, not life. Or she's thinking about the lone end of life. Do you like to read Suresh? No? Karen?
But little brought her mind upon their sense, a death, not life, she thought, a life's long end. Love in her bosom hurt with the jagged edges of anguish mourned every step, with pain crying, now, now perhaps his voice will cease forever. Yeah. Even by some vague touch oppressed, sometimes her eyes looked round as if their orbs might see the dim and dreadful goal's approach. Such a one unposed. He meant to finish his labor here, that happy, linked, uncaring. They too might wander free in the green deep, primeval mystery of the forest heart. A tree that raised its tranquil head to heaven, luxuriating in verdure, summoning the breeze with amorous wideness of its boughs. He chose, and with his steel assailed the arm, brown, rough, and strong, hidden in its emerald dress. Wordless, but near she watched, no turn to lose of the bright face and body that she loved. Her life was now in seconds, minutes, hours, and everyone polarized like a field merchant sword.
Do you want to carry on, or will you stop there? Helmut.
Her life was now in seconds, not in hours, and every moment she economized like a pale merchant, leaped above his sword, the miser of his poor remaining. But such a one yielded the joys and sang highest of the faith of times, the field of combat dead in demons' name, and sometimes paused to cry to hoarsely speech in love. Mockery, tender rather, she like a tempest leaped words and carried him, but as he worked, his doom upon the violent and hungry hound came, traveled through his body, biting and past silent, and all his suffering breath drove the rent like half poison. Then held his blood as if a beast had left its prey, a moment in a vague, literally reborn to strength, and happy ease he stood, rejoicing and resumed his confident toil, but with less serious thoughts. Now the grave achieved and his labor ceased. Lifted his arm, he flung away the poison far from him like an instrument of pain.
Thank you. Tinaka.
In him was a silent anguish at last, and he cried to her, solitude, a pain cleaves through my head and breast as if the axe were piercing it and not a living branch. Such agony rends me as the tree must feel when it is sundered and must lose its life. But while let me lay my head upon thy lap and guard me with thy hands from evil fate, perhaps because thy precious death may come. Then Savitri set other branches wide, cool, green against the sun, not the herb tree which has keen axe-head cloven that she shunned, but leaned beneath a fortunate kingly trunk. She guarded him in her bosom and strove to soothe his anguished brow and body with her hands. All grief and fear were dead within her now, and a great calm had fallen. The wish to lessen his suffering, the impulse that opposes pain, were the only mortal feeling left past. Briefless and strong, she waited by the cross.
Thank you. Rani, would you read?
But now the sweet familiar hue was changed into a tarnished grayness, and his eyes brimmed over, forsaken of the clear light she loved. Only the dull and physical mind was left, vacant of the bright spirit's luminous gaze. But once, before it faded wholly back, he cried out in a clinging last despair, Savitri, Savitri, O Savitri, lean down my soul and kiss me while I die. And even as her pallid lips pressed his fell, losing last sweetness of response, his cheek pressed down her golden arm. She sought his mouth still with her living mouth, as if she could persuade his soul back with her kiss, then grew aware they were no more alone.
Thank you. Larry?
Something had come there, conscious, vast, and dying. Near her she felt a silent shade immense, chilling the noon with darkness for its bed. An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, contemning all with its unbearable gaze, and with immortal lids and a vast brow, it saw in its immense destroying thought all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight, the worsening of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things, and life that would be forever but never was, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease, as if from a silence without form or name, the shadow of a remote, uncaring God, doomed to his naught, the illusory universe, canceling its show of idea and act in time and its imitation of eternity. She knew that visible death was standing there, and Satchelan had passed her embrace.
So again, this is labeled Canto 3, Death in the Forest, because very little change, very little alteration was made by Sri Aurobindo to this canto in all those years that he was working on the poem from the first version, with the earliest known version that we have is dated 1916. So it was probably another 30 years before this point was reached again. Sri Aurobindo has divided his poem into three parts. And the first part runs from the beginning of the poem up to the end of Canto 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. The Book of the Divine Mother. The Book of the Divine Mother, which has four cantos. And in the last canto, if you remember, King Asvapati begs the mother to incarnate herself in order to help humanity to become what it should be. And she grants that prayer of his. And that then there just come a few lines of Asvapati's return to earth, which he has entered the subtle worlds at the beginning of Book 2, and all those 15 cantos and four more cantos of Book 3, and that has comprised the whole of Part 1 of Sri Aurobindo's poem. So now we are embarking on Part 3, which covers Books 9 to 12. In between we had Part 2, which told Savitri's story, beginning at the beginning of Book 4. So now we can move on to the third and last part of the poem, which begins with Book 9, the Book of Eternal Night. This is on page 571. But again, there's no number on this page. The next page is 572. Book 9, the Book of Eternal Night. This has two cantos. The first one is called Towards the Black Void. Sonia, would you like to read?
Canto 1, Towards the Black Void. So was he left alone in the woods, surrounded by a dim, unthinking world. Her husband's corpse on her forsaken breast, in her vast, silent spirit, motionless. She measured not her loss with helpless thoughts, nor rendered tears, the marble seals of pain, she rose not yet to face the death, but over her, over the body, she loved, her soul leaned out in a great stillness without stir or voice. As if her mind had died at such a moment, but still the human heart in her beat on, aware still of his being near to her. Those knees he clasped to her, the most lifeless form, as though to guard the oneness they had, to keep the spirit still. veil is torn, anger is no more. Only the spirit sees and all is known, and a calm power seated above, seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness here bears the forces of the world in both our most nature, looks on us. It shapes the moon to be far seen, untouched and tranquil, amid error and tears and measureless above our striving will. Its gaze controls the turbulent world of things to make the glory its spirit from the voice of life. It seems to infinite sounds, the moment when great wings of lightning come and godlike thoughts surprise the mind of earth into the soul's splendor and intensity. Crescent of miraculous birth is tossed, whose horn of mystery flows in a bright void, as into a heaven of strength and silence taught, cherished all this living mortal day, as seized and swift in a swift and fiery flood, it touches shape by a harmonious unseen, a new sight comes, new voices in us form, a body of the music of the gods, immortal yearnings without name, deep down, large carvings of godheads, kingdom, and leave upon a crossing field of farm a high and longing ecstasy of the world. This inner moment's death was born in her.
Thank you. As we read about this still power seated above our brows, it reminds me of one of Sri Aurobindo's sonnets, The Godhead, which is an autobiographical account of how in the first year of his stay in Baroda, after he had returned from England in 1993, he was employed by the Gaikwad of Baroda, and I suppose he was given a coach to ride about in. And he tells how in the crowded market street, something frightened the horse and it bolted. And the street was so crowded, and perhaps Sri Aurobindo was not so skilled in controlling a horse by the reins. He had avoided taking his riding test when he was in England. So, but at that moment, he felt this presence, this calm presence above the brows, which was in fact controlling his fate. So something similar happens now to Savitri at this moment. I can't see who's sitting up at the top there. Do you want to read? We're on page 572 in the middle. 572. We'll read again at line 48. Now to the limitless gaze.
Now to the limitless gaze, disclosed that sees things barred from human thinking's earthly lips. The spirit who had hidden in nature's soul out of his luminous nest within the worlds like a vast fire is climbing the skies of night. Thus were the cords of self-obedient torn, like one who looks up to far heights he saw, ancient and strong, as on a windless summit above her, where she had worked in her lone mind, laboring apart in a soul power of self, the source of all which she had seemed or wrought, a power projected into cosmic space, a slow embodiment of the aconic will, a starry fragment of the eternal truth, the passionate instrument of an unmoved power. A presence was there that filled the listening worlds, a central all assumed by boundless life, a sovereignty, a silence, and swift release, one brooded over abysses. Who was she? As in a chronic, as in a robe comes a force descended, trailing endless lights, linking time seconds to infinity. Illuminatingly it girt the earth and her. It sank into her soul and she was changed. Then, like a thought fulfilled by some great word that might assume a symbol form, her being's face quivered with its touch. It covered her as with immortal wings, on its lips the curl of the unuttered truth. A halo of wisdom's lightnings for its crown, it entered the mystic lotus in her head, a thousand petaled home of power and light. Immortal leader of her mortality, doer of her works and fountain of her world, invulnerable by time, omnipotent, it stood above her calm, immobile, mute.
Thank you. So this is quite a strong experience, no? This moment when a calm power which is seated above our brows, above the head, is seen. This is a tremendous change which comes over Savitri, as it can come over any of us at special moments of our lives, when the veil between this world and the subtle world is torn. The thinker falls silent, only the spirit sees, and then all is known. Then we see that calm power, that Godhead seated above the brows, and we become aware that that stillness is feeling and carrying the voices of the world, but it itself is unmoving. It moves nature. It sees the play of life, and it is preparing its own future and its purposes. It shapes immutably. As it shapes those events of the future, they will not be changed. They are immutable. It decides what will happen. It is that power is untouched, tranquil, amid all the error and tears of our human life. It's vast, measureless, above our striving wills, all the things we project and want to choose. No? But its gaze, the gaze of that power, controls the turbulent whirl of things. Even if we're being carried away by a terrified horse in the midst of a crowd, this power is able to contain and master everything. Its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things, like a whirlpool or a tsunami. The spirit then within us grows to mate with that glory, to match it. The voice of our life gets tuned to infinite sound, and we feel the moments of human time passing on great wings of lightning, and godlike thoughts surprise the mind of earth. Then it's like crescent moon appears in the soul's splendor. Crescent of miraculous birth, the newborn moon. It's floating in a bright emptiness. So then the thought is seized, carried away, as into a heaven of strength and silence. And all this body, all this mortal clay is seized, and it too gets shaped by a swift and fiery flood. Some intense flood of feelings shapes the body, a body of the music of the gods, shaped by a harmonist unseen. We don't know who's doing this shaping, but it's a very powerful presence. Then we receive into us immortal yearnings. They leap down to us. Large quiverings of Godhead, of divinity, are looking for us. They run and weave on this powerful field of calm, a high and lonely ecstasy of will. Our will is changed into a much higher form. So all this, just in a moment, but a deep, deep moment, is born in Savitri at this point in time. And then she sees the spirit who has been hidden in her nature, rising up like a great bird out of his luminous nest within the worlds. It's climbing up like a vast fire through these skies of night. And thus were the cords of self-oblivion torn. The soul remembers itself. It has been forgotten. Now the memory of all its past comes. So for Savitri, it's like she's looking up to far heights of great mountains. She sees right up on these summits, ancient and strong, as if they're poised there on an absolutely silent summit, like a Himalayan peak above her. And she realized that's where she had been working in her lone mind, laboring apart in her own soul tower, her solitary strength. But what she sees above is the source of everything which she has seemed to be in her life and everything which she has done in her life. A power. She knows herself as a power that's been projected into cosmic space. She's been embodied slowly by the aeonic will, the timeless will, the eternal will. She's become a starry fragment of the eternal truth, the passionate instrument of an unmoved power. She has intensities of feeling and knowledge and experience, but all this is shaped by an unmoving power. She realizes that she herself is a presence that filled the listening worlds. A central all, everything, takes on her life, which has become boundless, without limit. She experiences her higher self as a sovereignty, a ruling power, a silence and a swiftness. One brooded over abysses, the deep depths of things. And this one is she herself. And then the experience becomes even richer. It's as if she's clothed in a robe of sound, of song, choric robe, of unheard sound. This force descends, trailing endless lights. This force is linking, connecting the seconds of time to infinity, endlessness. Without any limit, that force ties together the earth and herself. It sank into her soul and she was changed. And then that mightiness takes on a symbol form. He says it's like a thought being fulfilled by some great word. Great thoughts may come to us and we may not find words to express them. But if they get expressed in words, they're given so much power, you know, greater power. So this form is coming down and descending into her and taking her over. It sank into her soul and she was changed. And this mightiness takes on a symbol shape, a symbol form. All the spaces of her being quivered with its touch. It covers her as with immortal wings, the protective immortal wings of a great bird or an angel. She sees a face. On its lips, the curve of the unuttered truth, the truth which has not yet been expressed. There's a halo of lightnings as its crown, and all this enters into this special chakra above the head. It entered the mystic light lotus in her head, that thousand-petaled home of power and light. That force becomes the immortal leader of her mortality, of her humanity. It becomes the one who is doing her works, the source of whatever words she will speak. It can't be touched by time. It is all-powerful, and it's standing above her, protecting, guiding, expressing. It stood above her, calm, immobile, mute. Juan, would you read?
All in her made it with that might, as if the last dragon had been slain by death of the humanity that once was her, assuming a spiritual white control, making life see a mirror of heaven's sky. The young divinity in her earthly limbs, filled with celestial strength, her mortal part. Over was the haunted pain, the rending fear. Her grief had passed away, her mind was still. Her heart beat quietly with a sovereign voice. There came a freedom from the heartstrings clutch. Now all her eggs sprang from a godhead's calm. Calmly, she laid upon the forest soil the dead who still reposed upon her breast and bore to turn away from the dead form. So now she rose to meet the dreadful God. That mightier spirit turned its mastering gaze on life and things, inherited of a world left to it unfinished from a halting past. When yet mine, the passionate learner toy and ill-shaped instruments were transcended now was the poor human rule. A sovereign power was there, a godlike will. A moment yet she lingered motionless and looked down on the dead man at her feet. Then, like a tree recovering from a wind, she raised her noble hand, fronting her gaze. Something stood there, an earthly, something grand, a limitless denial of all being, that war, the terror and wonder of a shape. In its appalling eyes, the tenebrous form bore the deep pity of destroying gods. A sorrowful eye curved the dreadful lips that speak the word of doom. Eternal night in the dire beauty of an immortal face, pitying a rose, receiving all that lives forever into its faithless heart, refuge of creatures from the anguish and world pain. His shape was nothingness made real. His limbs were moments of transience and the deep brows of unwearied calm. Large, godlike lids, silent, beheld the writhing serpent, like unmoved, their timeless, wide, unchanging gaze. Had seen the unprofitable cycles pass, survived the passing of unnumbered snow, and sheltered still the same immutable art.
Thank you. Thank you. I didn't say it loudly enough. Thank you. Again.
The two opposed each other with their eyes, woman and universal God, around her, piling their voice unbearable loneliness upon her mighty, uncompanioned soul. Many inhuman solitudes came close. Vacant eternities from living hope laid upon her a huge and lifeless look, and to hear ears silencing earthly sounds, a sad and formidable voice arose, which seemed the whole adverse world. Unclasp, it cried, thy passionate influence, and relax, O slave of nature, changing tool of changeless law, who vainly risks rebellion to my yoke. Thy elemental grasp, weep and forget, and tomb thy passion in its living grave. Leave now the once loved spirit's abandoned robe. Pass lonely back to thy vain life on earth. It ceased, she moved not, and it spoke again. lower its mighty key to human chords. Yet the dread cry behind the uttered sounds, echoing all sadness and immortal scorn, moaned like a hunger of far wandering waves. Wilt thou forever keep thy passionate hope, thyself a creature doomed like him to pass, denying his soul death's calm and silent rest? Relax thy grasp. This body is earth's and thine. His spirit now belongs to a great home. Woman, thy husband suffers. Savagely drew back and heart's force, and clasped his body still, where from her lap renounced on the smooth grass. Softly it lay, as often before in sleep, when from their couch she rose in the white dawn, called by her daily task. Now too, as if called, she rose and stood guarded alone, like one who drops his mantle for her race. Raised the signal motionless, she knew not to what course. Her spirit above, on the crypt summit of her secret form, like one left sentinel on a mountain crest, a fiery fruit lander, puissant wings, watched flaming silent with her voiceless soul, like a still sail upon a windless sea. Wild passionless it rode, anchored blind, waiting what far-reached impulse could arise, out of the eternal depths cast its surface.
Thank you, thank you. So, of course, when death tells her that Satyavan is suffering, she has to release him and let him move freely. So she draws back that force, that will of her heart, which is holding him still. It's the body is lying on the smooth grass. It's often lain beside her like that before, no? And she would get up in the morning, called by her daily task, and leave Satyavan sleeping or lying. So, but now she stands up. She stands up, gathers all her strength. It's like somebody preparing, an athlete preparing for a race, waiting for the signal, with all his swiftness held ready, waiting for the signal, motionlessly swift. All the speed that's there in the potential in the body is held waiting the signal to move. She doesn't know where she will be led now. Her spirit is above her, watching, silent, and her soul is like a still sail upon a windless sea, a boat not moving. It's riding at anchor, waiting to see what kind of wave or surge is going to come and carry it. That far-ridged impulse will come out of eternal depths and indicate the direction which is to be taken. I would like us to stop there for this morning. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.